Well, good morning. Well, good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And our timing got a little off with some of the subjects here, but
This is called the British. This program is at least two thirds. The British are coming. Look out, you guys. Because what's the first track? Is the first track the Modern Jewish Table?
Yeah, they're Jewish princesses.
And it was a great surprise to discover that these two Jewish princesses actually live in London, England, in a substantially Jewish section called Golders Green.
Yeah, which you knew about.
Which I know very well. I used to work not more than 5 miles away from Golders Green. Mm-hmm. And a couple of people on our staff, that's where they lived.
Well, Tracy Fine and Georgie Tarn have a good, fresh, modern take on what it means to serve these holiday meals.
And they're also, by the way, an absolute barrel of laughs.
They are.
why don't we let them provide the entertainment instead of us?
Great. Well, I've talked to a lot of Jewish princesses, but not this particular duo of Tracy Fine and Georgie Tarn, is it? Tarn. Yeah, okay. And you were in London, and so you have a little twist on your Jewish roots in London, I would say. Your book, though, is like international, The Modern Jewish Table.
Now, I just have one thing I want to introduce here at the beginning, and then you can say, well, why would you say that? We're obviously accomplished cooks, but here in the United States, there are characters called Jewish American princesses, otherwise known as Japs, and the joke is, what does a Jap make for dinner?
And the answer
is reservations. Yeah, right. Now, I heard that here. I didn't hear it in Golders Green.
Well, anyhow, these two attractive women have a blog. What else do you have? You have all kinds of social media.
Oh, we have Instagram, we have Twitter, yes. We have YouTube. Family, please look us up.
Yeah, well, my favorite thing is that you describe all your operations, your social media, your writing, as across your lifestyle, as a cross between Sex and the City and Desperate Housewives. Now, how did you come to that?
This is Georgie here. So when we first started writing the book, we wanted something upbeat and sassy that reflected ourselves. And this is Tracy here. Georgie and I have known each other since we were 8 years old, so we're going back a bit. So we know exactly when we speak, we finish each other's sentences. We're very much like sisters, really, even closer. So we knew where we were coming from. We wanted to change how the world saw Jewish cooking. So that's how we got there.
That's a pretty big mission.
Well, but we have had a lot of modern Jewish authors.
I don't think anyone's tried for quite such a revolutionary concept as the one you just mentioned.
Do that again. Here, and I just think that lifestyle plays an enormous part of cooking. It's part of your everyday life, and therefore we bring a little bit of glamour and chutzpah to the kitchen with a kind of comedic, self-deprecating writing with amazing recipes.
Right, what kind
and obviously
of response
we're
going, do you
we
get?
Want family to be involved in it and friends, so that's the journey so far.
What is your response in general? Probably positive in your community. What about a broader audience? I mean, you travel quite a lot to interact with. You were in Spain earlier.
This is Tracy speaking. Yeah, we've done a few book tours of America. This is our fourth book that's come out. So we've spoken to lots of people, discussed how great chicken soup is and different variants on it. So it's been amazing to see people's responses. We've done in England, we have big stores like Harrods and Selfridges where we've done book signings, and we've met some amazing people who have become great fans and just keep following us. And the reason we wanted to write the books to begin with was really to reach across the table to everybody, because I think for some people, Jewish food and Jewish lifestyle may be a bit mysterious or they don't know a lot about it. So we wanted to write it in a way that we wanted to invite everybody to the table, whatever their ethnicity or religion, so that we could really share our food, which is what it's all about. It's the sort of center of Judaism, is eating. And yes. So we felt that we encapsulated it in easy cooking with easy writing that's fun and sort of has a comedic tone, so that people would enjoy reading it.
Yeah, you bring some interesting characters in there. Was I reading correctly? Moses is in there somewhere.
Yes, because when he went, this is Georgie, when he went up, he came down with the laws, and we're not allowed to have dairy after meat. So we wanted to create a section on dairy-free desserts, which is actually very in. Loads of people are not eating dairy.
It's right. Lactose intolerant.
So we felt that Moses came down with these rules, and he gave us another burden, which was to try and find a substitute for cream when cooking desserts.
And
I think we've come up with some fantastic recipes, actually, from our Zabaglione onwards. We really spent a lot of time looking at dairy-free desserts because it's very big for the kosher cook.
Now,
and we've got a wonderful recipe, apple pear and honey pudding, which is great for next week, the week after the Jewish New Year that's coming up, where we always try and have something honey with honey in it because it's a sweet New Year. And also, in all our books, we always try and use the traditional challah, but take a JP twist on it. So for this book, we created the Russia challah pudding. So it's based on a bread and butter pudding, but made with dairy-free margarine and with caramelized apple. And Tracy and I couldn't stop tasting it because it was so amazing. Oh, and I forgot. I think you like a wee dram of whiskey. It's got some lovely whiskey in it.
Oh, how do you know we like a wee dram of whiskey?
Oh, we've been listening to you.
We've been listening to us.
You know, one of my favorite...
All our secrets are out.
One of my favorite the phrases you use here, that's not the exact word. You have here about the Jewish diaspora, and then - Sephardic, Ashkenazi, and Mizrahi. I laugh so hard. How many people will get that, do you think?
Well, we try and explain through, but we have a lot of friends here in London that really do come from all over the place, and even for myself, I've discovered that I have Portuguese roots, so we are a kind of global
melting pot of people, yeah.
So I have a little bit of Ashkenazi and a little bit of Sephardi in me, and it's nice to explore those different recipes because they're so interesting.
And this is Tracy here. I'm Ashkenazi, and I have my Russian roots. My parents, grandparents, all from Russia.
Yeah, but who wears Mizrahi?
We're in the Middle East.
Yeah. No.
Well, that would probably cover my sister-in-law.
Yeah, my sister-in-law too. Yeah.
She's coming tonight. She's Yemenite.
Oh, yeah, right.
They're Mizrahi. They're known as Mizrahi.
Yeah. Well, interestingly, let's slide back to the subject of chicken soup for just a second, because Miss Anne will argue with you that it can't be chicken soup if it doesn't have dill in it.
Right.
That's very American. Is Georgie here? That's very, very American. I mean, we always put parsley in our soup. We never put dill in our chicken soup. But you'll have to come. We'll have to have a chicken soup competition and see who wins.
Yes, because I believe you have some English family. So when you come round next, you can come for Friday night dinner here.
We do. The closest is actually in Queen's Park.
Oh, down the corner. Right. Very trendy area now.
Not far from you at all.
Is it now trendy? It certainly was expensive before it was trendy.
It's full of wonderful restaurants, and yes, it's a really trendy, want-to-live place. Yep.
Okay, hold on a second. I wasn't finished with the chicken soup.
Oh, okay.
Because we discovered another Middle Eastern cookbook, and in that there was a recipe for Yemeni chicken soup, which contained a very interesting ingredient called turmeric.
Yes.
Yes.
And we tried both dried and fresh turmeric, and it's really good.
In the soup.
Oh, well, we'll have to take that on board. But we do have a Yemenite meat soup, thanks to my sister-in-law, who kind of passed over the secret. And that's got some, I don't know how you pronounce it, hawaiij, which you can get in Middle Eastern grocery stores, and that really gives it a kick.
Now, what is it? What is that exactly? I saw that.
It's a spice mix, and it's spice mix you can get, and it's quite spicy.
Okay.
Now, you have lots of information in this book. I want to convey some of the really strong sections, such as, what type of cook are you? And I thought that was a wonderful section. I mean, it sort of it brought everybody into this book and made them part of your style, of lifestyle and of cooking.
Well, Anne, so the question is, are you a rustic fantastic, or are you a silver service, or are you the health nut, or the look don't cook?
I'd say a little of all.
I like the last.
Which I think exactly, we're all a bit. Which are you, Tracy? I think I'm a bit of everything. I veer more to the rustic fantastic because I like to cook large.
Well, you know, this is the second book that I've picked up lately that explains how to set a table. That shows where we are in our cultural devolvement. I'll use that term, I think, appropriately at this point. You explain how to set the table, right?
I think it's very interesting, though. I was just going to butt in there. But we've had a lot of people who are newlyweds by this book, and actually in our previous books, and lots of young girls, 13-year-olds, 12-year-olds, for bat mitzvah presents. So it's nice to have those little
we just want to encourage everyone, don't we, Georgie, because it's like people get, sometimes they get a bit worried and they find it quite daunting, and we've made it so easy and showed them that entertaining can be easy.
Yeah, no,
and it's more fun than going out to a restaurant if you do it properly.
And I think
there's loads of imagination when you bring to the table. You know, in the autumn you can go and gather leaves and nuts. You can go in the summer and you can bring apples and summer fruit.
The flowers.
Yeah, I mean, for Rosh Hashanah next week, we will take apples, we'll core them, we'll put candles in
them. Pomegranate, because we always like to have something different to eat at the new year, don't we?
Yes, little jars of honey. You know, you can really make your table the center stage, and if you like creating props, you know, that's something really fun to do.
Now, we were teaching, we have an 8-year-old grandson, and we were teaching him about the table setting, and I told him about the dessert spoon at the top of the plate, and he took that in. I didn't realize how much, but I said, this is what you use when you have a dessert. So the next day he came to the table and he went, oh no. Guess what?
No spoons, no dessert.
He's forgotten the dessert.
Dessert was the problem. Now, you do have a very large selection here of desserts. And I've never seen such a huge chapter on chocolate in a general cookbook.
Oh, it's my favorite. I'm sorry, it's Tracy speaking. I had to have it in the book. It's something I find all us women have a certain time of the month. We have our store of chocolate, and we absolutely have to go there. So we had to do a whole section on it. I read somewhere that if it said, if there's no chocolate in heaven, I don't want to go. I agree. I so agree. So we had such fun with that chapter, you know, creating chocolate orange churros.
Yes, chocolate orange churros is wonderful. That's pure invention, right?
You have to try the dark chocolate amaretto cake. It really is heavenly.
An apple strudel with rum-soaked sultanas, that's a must.
Well, and then, of course, we did dive into Rock on Rocky Road, a little bit for America. Did you see the picture of that? It's in the book of the Rocky Road.
Oh, yes, 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 yes.
I make that on a weekly basis for my children.
Oh, really? My goodness.
Oh, yes.
And tell me.
In fact, I think we both eat chocolate every single day.
Oh, wow.
I hold my hand up to it.
Definitely. I go there
every day.
I would say the most startling image you have, however, is your popcorn cake.
Oh, wow, yes, that's beautiful, isn't it? That's a real piece. That's really for somebody who's celebrating something special.
Oh, it's gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous.
Thank you. It's a very easy cake to make as well.
Describe it to our listeners.
It's a buttermilk cake with a mascarpone frosting, and then it's piled up with popcorn at the top. If you don't have to, you could literally ice each one if you wanted to create that tower, or just spread it. So in the picture, it's a beautiful pink background, this gorgeous, sumptuous cake, and then topped with popcorn. I dare anyone not to have a slice or two.
Yeah, some of the concoctions are really splendid, though. I mean, fish blintzes. I never in my life.
Oh, they're brilliant to make, those ones. They're a staple. Every week we have them in our house. Everybody loves them. And you can freeze them as well. And the good thing about making a fish blintz, if you're an amateur cook or someone that's just starting the kitchen, you're learning three things there. You're learning how to make a cheese sauce, you're learning how to make the crepe, and you're learning how to cook the fish. So it's such a good dish.
That sounds like it, right.
And the baked salmon fish cakes with polenta fries are my favorite.
Oh, really?
On the next page, yeah. They are delicious. They're great in the summer or in the winter with a salad. They're just such an easy dinner to make. Doesn't take long to do it.
Well, you
and polenta fries are something special. Just, you know, they really are incredible. And we work long and hard on those to really pack some punch into them, because often polenta is quite bland.
It is bland, yes. You, of course, have the obligatory Bakewell tart.
Have you had Bakewell tart? That's a very British thing.
Of course.
I never liked it.
Oh, you'll like ours. Try ours. Please bake ours. Or if you don't like that, try the pear and chocolate fancy pan tart with a chocolate pastry. That's incredible. Absolutely yummy. Oh, I'm getting hungry, Georgie. Well, you must try. Are you into shortbread? We have lovely lavender lovelies.
Oh, I noticed that. That's one of my favorite things, is shortbread.
Well, there you go. Please try the recipes and tell us how you got on.
They're really pretty, too, with a little sprig of the lavender on
them. We get very excited about food.
Well, I can tell. Well, listen, listeners.
Very, very excited.
You know, it's easy to get bored if you have the same thing your whole life, every year, every week, and so forth. This book elevates the whole experience. The food is modern, it's global, it's fun to read, and it's beautifully presented. Well,
Oh, that means the world to hear that from you. Thank you. We really appreciate that, because we've really put our heart and soul, and we like to feel that everything we do is with that magic ingredient of love that we put into our books. We really work long and hard, so it's great that you love it.
Well, next time we're in London, I guess we're scheduled for a bake-off.
Okay. No, you're scheduled for a Friday night dinner. You don't have to do the cooking. We'll do it. You just do the eating.
Okay. Well, young ladies, thank you so much for joining us today.
Tracy Fine and Georgie Tarn, the Jewish princesses.
Thank you very much.
And again, it's the Modern Jewish Table. And rush out and get this so that you can celebrate the holidays coming up in a very modern way. Thank you, too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more spokespersons for my native land of Great Britain, United Kingdom, whatever you call it, right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, most people think that the highlight of this job, what makes it so wonderful, is what we get to eat. And in fact, as I've said before, that's not it at all. It's who we meet and also what we learn. And boy, this next couple, really Bronwyn and Francis Percival, really.
Bronwyn,
okay.
It's a Welsh name.
Yeah, okay. It looks Welsh, actually.
Yep.
Anyhow, we learned a ton from them. Their book is Reinventing the Wheel, Milk, Microbes, and the Fight for Real Cheese. And boy, it was an eye-opener, that discussion.
Yeah, their concern, in case you didn't get it, is that what do they call it? Cheese made from
raw milk
is not only absolutely the best, but it's really very good for you, and it's not bad for you at all. And Bronwyn puts her money where her mouth is, because she's been one of the leaders in reviving the custom cheese production in the United Kingdom, which she says in our interview looked like it was going to die.
Yeah, now it's coming
and
back.
Now it's absolutely is coming back. And it's knowledgeable people like Francis and Bronwyn who are helping to make that happen. And if you're the least bit interested in cheese, this is a book you'll want to read, because you'll realize just exactly how much you didn't know.
Exactly. Bronwyn and Francis Percival have written an absolutely amazing book called Reinventing the Wheel. And, of course, the wheel we're talking about is cheese. It's subtitled Milk, Microbes, and the Fight for Real Cheese. And first of all, I'm amazed at your qualifications. They're extraordinary. Just give us a little bit of your background, Francis.
I am really the person who is least of cheese in this partnership. My background is as a writer about food and wine. I'm the food editor of a wine magazine, right. The World of Fine Wine here in London. I essentially married into cheese. So
yes.
In marrying Bronwyn, I'm married into this debate. And I think that out of the book, more than anything else, it dramatizes the debates that we have at our own sort of kitchen table at home about why isn't cheese more like wine? How can we understand these things better? And I think it's we've been married almost for a decade now, and it's one of those things where it's sort of either you write the book or you get divorced. So
I'm worried about the solidity of your marriage, because that keeps coming up. Anyhow, our other guest is Bronwyn Percival, and talk about impressive. You are a buyer for one of our most favorite cheese companies in the whole world, Neal's Yard Dairy in London.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. No, I sort of fell into cheese in a slightly different way than Francis. I was originally interested in science, and I studied biochemistry as an undergraduate, and gradually got interested in the world of food and came to the UK to study anthropology. I was doing my master's at Oxford, and as for my dissertation, I wrote about EU food law and protected food names and sort of constructed ideas of tradition, and there was no better subject for study in that respect than cheese, and so that really brought me into contact with the people at Neal's Yard Dairy, and the rest is history.
Yes.
Now, who is it who has milk in the family?
She does.
That's
you. So you had milk in the family as well.
And raised
absolutely.
Goats.
I guess maybe genetically I was predisposed to be interested in dairy products, because my great-grandfather was a Swiss dairy farmer who emigrated to the United States in the early, the very early years of the 20th century, and started a dairy farm in San Bernardino County that grew with the times and ultimately ended up milking, over 2,000 cows in the high California desert by the time I really got to know it well. And it was a very interesting parable for us as we were looking at writing the book of basically how following the best advice from all of the authorities,
yes,
at every point had ended, my family's farm in a place that was ultimately not viable for them. And really, in my work now, where I'm doing a lot of work with small farmers and cheesemakers in particular, really we're finding that economic interest lies at the opposite side of the spectrum, where you have small farms that are adding value by doing something utterly unique.
Okay, so they're creating their own space in the market because their product is so good. And I want to come back to, before we conclude, to the enormous success that artisan American cheesemakers seem to be achieving, which is not something that you would necessarily expect. In fact, quite the opposite is what you might expect.
Yes,
but I think
I don't know. I think the interesting thing about the U.S. is essentially when you look at average herd size in U.S. dairying, it's the middle that's falling out. There are still large numbers of people operating with the sorts of smallish herds that, and by that I mean probably under 200, under 150 cows, that are ideal for raw milk farmhouse cheese making. And all right, these sorts of cheeses that we talk about are never something that's going to be made on with the milk from a mega dairy, and I think that's one of their great attractions. But when I look at the sort of statistics on U.S. dairy farming, I'm actually, to be honest, surprised that there aren't more farmhouse cheeses being made. It seems a much better way as a farmer to remove yourself from the commodity market, from the brutality of that liquid milk market, and really make something that captures the uniqueness of your own farm, that really gives the consumer the sort of the tasteable chance to engage with every facet of your farming and your place.
Well, you know, it's hard. It's a struggle. I mean, Pennsylvania is where we are living, and we've been that liquid milk supplier for, I don't know, generation after generation, but they're starting to do the farmstead cheese making here now. But I've just read friends of ours who have a goat farm. They're fighting. They want to put high utility lines running right through their property, and it's an uphill battle. I mean, it's not even they're in a farm preserve, I mean, preservation area, and still they're having to fight. And the scale is very difficult to compete, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's one of the things that we really see is that farmhouse cheesemaking has the opportunity to add quite a lot of value compared to the commodity price of liquid milk, but I think at the same time, it's still not a profession in which anyone is getting rich. And I think ultimately, for this sort of cheesemaking to be truly sustainable, it needs to be the sort of thing where the next generation will see that actually being the route to becoming a superstar isn't leaving the farm and going off to become a banker or a doctor or a high-flying lawyer, but ultimately to stay on the farm and make this, you know, world-class cheese and be a superstar that way.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wanted to take just a second to reflect on the impact that your employer, Neil's Yard, has had on the cheese market in the United Kingdom, because what people told us is that you really play an absolutely vital role in being willing to buy whole cheeses from farmers and affinage them, and the farmer has his money and you have a product and you're willing to warehouse it and keep it and sort of dole it out to the market as the market wants it. And that seems kind of special, and I don't know that we have anybody doing that here.
You know, it's really interesting. I think there are some interesting models within the U.S., and really the stroke of genius of the person who really made Neil's Yard Dairy what it is today, his name is Randolph Hodgson, and what he saw in the early 80s that nobody else saw was that actually there was an interested market for these old traditional farmhouse cheeses that were on the brink of extinction because supermarkets were telling these producers, we can't handle the textures of your cheeses, the cloth binding, there's too much wastage, they're too hard to handle, and they're too expensive. And really what all customers want are just vacuum-packed blocks of supermarket cheese that are really convenient for us at supermarkets to sell. But actually, looking at it from the other side of point of view, consumers, when presented with the opportunity to taste real sort of farmhouse British cheeses, were amazed that there were such things out there and, of course, wanted to buy them. And I think what Neil's Yard Dairy has succeeded so well in doing is being that link between producer and consumer and buying directly from farmers and then being able to pass the feedback from our customers and our shops and, you know, now our wholesale and export customers as well. When we hear from our customers that they love those cheeses and that they want to buy more of them, or conversely, that they're really not cutting the mustard and that they should be a lot better, we then can pass that information back, that feedback to the cheesemakers and complete that feedback loop. And I think go ahead, Francis.
I think that Bronwyn is actually somewhat underselling Niels Yard Dairy there in terms of if you were to write the history of the 20th century with a view to eliminating expertise in farmhouse cheesemaking within the United Kingdom, you would pretty much write the history as it happened. In that from having in the 1890s and around the early 1900s a world-leading infrastructure of expertise, of not just of cheesemakers, but of people who could teach you to make cheese, of cheese schools, of tradesmen who could come in, and all those sort of ancillary industries who could service your cheese store and things like that. And we lost those completely over the course of the 20th century for a variety of reasons. And one of the things that Niels Yard Dairy does is it's not, and I think particularly Bronwyn's work at Niels Yard Dairy, is not so much just a person who, a company that buys and sells cheese, but a company that acts as an institutional memory for British cheese that is involved. So before we started the book project, and something that Bronwyn still runs, is her conference on the science of artisan cheese, bringing together research scientists and cheesemakers and practitioners so that they can have that conversation about what do we need to know. And I think to Niels Yard Dairy's great credit, they are, I would say, and I got into trouble once in an article I did for the Financial Times about this, but they are pushing more aggressively than perhaps their consumers are, in terms of that Niels Yard Dairy has a vision for what they would like British cheese to be, and this is a slightly controversial sentiment, but it's not necessarily where the status quo sits now in terms of what those cheeses are that customers want. There is a relentlessness in that sort of questioning of how can we make it better? How can we make this more interesting? Which is absolutely exemplary and would be a brilliant template for other people to follow in other countries.
No, absolutely. That Niels Yard Dairy has taken as its mission to improve British cheese, and I think that we, you know, it's such a, at once a sort of noble and naive statement, but I think that the feeling behind it is very genuine, that really, as Francis said, Britain has been extraordinarily successful at killing its farmhouse cheesemaking industry, and it needs all the help that it can get and all of those farmers need all the help they can get to actually revive it and make it into something interesting again. And the flip side of that is that if it does flourish, then we have lots of great cheese to sell, so everybody wins.
Now, interestingly enough, I can buy it within 500 yards of my house. thanks to the cheese buyers at Whole Food Markets. The only problem is it's very expensive, and I won't say that it's as expensive as Rogue Creamery cheese from the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah. Which you can't even get that. Rogue Blue.
No, it comes in a manly $39.95 a pound.
Yeah.
Well, Yard's a little bit less than that.
I need to do, I want to say that you said that there's no model for in the United States. Now, there was a model. If you remember, we went to a grand opening reception at Artisanal in New York City.
Oh, sure, yes.
And it was a total affidavit, the whole thing. They had the separate aging rooms for all these different cheeses, and they had a companion restaurant that was almost entirely cheese. Yeah, and so it went out of business, didn't it?
Yeah, I think it did. And you know, it's a shame because it's one of the places where, before I really even knew about Niels Yard Dairy, it was one of the places that first caught my imagination about cheese and that it could have so many different forms and flavors and be so gastronomically versatile. Was eating there in about 2004, 2005.
Right.
And so, yeah, no, it is very interesting. But again, like, affinage is where cheese maturing is one of those things that it, if the cheese is good, it's easy, and if the cheese has anything imbalanced about it, it will come out in the process of maturing it. And I think that that is one of the, one of the key risks to the affiner is getting this, level of quality all the time and bearing that risk.
Yeah.
I think what, in writing the book, one of our favorite, hours that we spent was talking with Laurent Dubois, who is an amazing affineur in Paris, and within the community of French affineurs who actually have a much better reputation within the French public than probably French cheesemakers. Most French people would struggle to name the name of a cheesemaker, but they might very easily be able to name the name of the celebrity affineur from whom they source their cheese.
Oh, interesting.
And Laurent Dubois is brilliant because he has three wonderful shops in Paris. His cheeses are amazing. And he is an utter revolutionary because he is committed to having on all of his labels the name of the producer.
Uh-huh.
And to us as Anglo-Saxons, that seems a given, but within the community of French cheese, or even of Swiss cheese or Italian cheese, where the appellation is everything, and then probably the affineur, the person who's aged it, is also the person who gets a lot of the credit.
Absolutely. One of the things that we've been told by French affineurs before is they can't believe that we put the names of the cheesemakers on the Neal's Yard Dairy labels. That they think in order to protect the value of what the maturer does, then you should say, well, this is Neal's Yard Dairy 12-month, this is Neal's Yard Dairy 14-month, and this is Neal's Yard Dairy 18-month cheese. But actually, that's sort of a situation, and this is exactly what they have for the most part in France, is really stultifying for the individual cheesemakers who then find that their own identity is lost in the crowd and they don't get the credit that they deserve for making cheeses that are extraordinary.
Well, how ironic for the French. I mean, if you buy a fleur de sel, they put the name of the person who gathered the salt, and it's all a lie. It's a lie.
Yeah.
I mean, every single box of the salt has the same person's name on it, which is impossible.
Hold on a second. Let's not change the subject.
Yeah.
Otherwise,
I'm going on because I hate the whole idea about laughing cow as well. Talk about the French. I'm sorry.
What we must do is, because there's no way we can do justice to this in this interview, but in order to understand cheese really well, you just have to read a book like this one, because it gets into what's in the milk, and some of that has to do with breed, and some of that has to do with place. I mean, you use the wine making term terroir in a chapter that I just started to read, and all of this is there. But
well, what about the microbes? I mean, we need to mention that.
I thought we should conclude the interview with a little bit on why it's okay to eat
raw milk
cheeses.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Who'd like to do that before we close the interview?
I don't know. What do you think, Francis? Do you want to take it?
If you take it, then I will interject if I
think there's anything. Okay, that's good. Just like everything else in our marriage. All right, so basically...
I'm getting really worried about your marriage.
I know. Counseling through interviews is really the way forward, I think. I think that basically it's really important to remember that the route to safe cheese is not magical providence or magical raw milk or magical good luck, but really good quality systems. And this is something that we focus a lot on in the EU, and that the U.S. legislation is being written more and more to take into account, that really this idea of hazard analysis, of looking at every single stage in your process and identifying the risks that are associated with each of those stages, and then identifying those simple controls that you can put in place to manage and bring down those risks to a reasonable level, that is the key to making safe food. And the nice thing about cheese, and particularly making farmhouse cheese, is that you have the vertical control over every single part of your process. So it's not just about bringing in a raw material that you have no control over and then putting it through a process. You can be the one who milks the cows, who sees what they get fed, who cleans the udder, who makes sure that milk gets used when it's totally fresh, and then sees it through this process very carefully. And then there's also the time built into the system, because you're making cheese, that you can do some microbiological testing to verify that your cheese actually is free from pathogens that you would need to worry about. So it's all, it's a really dull answer, but it is about good systems and good systems management, and it's really quite elementary when you strip away all of the emotion and the layers.
Well, are people actually doing this now? I mean,
absolutely. It's a legal requirement in the EU for every single cheesemaker or every single food producer, really, who's making food for sale needs to have what's called a HACCP plan, which is hazard analysis, critical control point. It is required for everybody of every scale. And the nice thing is that with the new Food Safety Modernization Act that was written and brought into law in 2012, the U.S. has adopted a very similar legal strategy. Now, that's only starting to be rolled out and implemented now. So I think that there are a lot of cheesemakers in the U.S. who I think are just getting used to the idea of doing this sort of hazard analysis and running systems in this way. But it absolutely works, and it is absolutely the legal expectation that people are moving in this direction.
Well, that's great. I mean, I think, because that's one of the things that always comes up, as you know, safety.
I think there's this perception that raw milk cheese is a high-risk food, but if you actually look at the statistics, it's no higher risk than, say, eating fresh vegetables or fresh salad leaves, that both of them are subject to the same sorts of risks, and that, a world in which you do not accept risk in the food that you eat is a world in which everything that we eat is either irradiated or canned and sterilized. And I just think we need to maybe reframe the terms that we use with cheese away from, raw milk cheese is high risk, to some raw milk cheeses are very microbiologically permissive. They will allow pathogens, if they are there, to grow to high levels and could potentially become dangerous. But that doesn't mean that those cheeses themselves are high risk to eat or carry a degree of risk that would be out of place when we compared it to, say, driving a car to work.
Right. And do you think everybody's going to eventually come around to that kind of a system?
Hmm? I think
your book is helpful.
If I can interject here, I think what's interesting is removing it out of what, when people think of raw milk cheese as in some way dangerous. Partly they should be thinking of soft and blue cheeses as equally as microbiologically permissive, but it's a judgment of cultural normalcy. It's that driving my car is fine because that's a culturally normative thing for me to do, whereas eating this cheese is in some way alien. It's one of the things with Brexit that British cheesemakers are, if they're sensible, are terrified about, is that being part of the EU, being regulated under the same schema that regulates particularly France and Italy, is brilliant, because these are countries where the value of these cheeses is understood, not just in terms of an emotional or a purely cultural value, but in terms of the extra economic value of making a raw milk cheese that can deliver unique properties, that completely removes you as the producer from a commodity market and actually delivers you an economic return. Whereas in debates about raw milk cheese in the US, nobody has yet, until we've published this book, has stood there and said, actually, there is extra value in making a raw milk cheese, because making a raw milk cheese allows you, as the consumer, to taste all of these good farming decisions that I've made. And so we can point to the individual attributes which are a consequence of my good farming. And then we can say, right, this is brilliant, because you as a consumer, now you can evaluate it yourself. You're not reliant on a regulator sort of stamping things and saying this is good farming or this is bad farming. You can actually interrogate that cheese yourself by eating it, by tasting it. And that is a value of raw milk cheese. And when you can get the extra economic return from that value, then we need to bring that into our debates about safety, so that we're considering it not as
all risk and no benefit.
Right.
Exactly. It's no benefit. That actually there are serious benefits to the structure of the industry and to the experience that the consumer can have.
Well, this book is absolutely de rigueur at this point, I think, in terms of understanding the current situation and the future of cheeses in the world, really, isn't it? I had actually, Francis, I wanted to ask you something about your wine. I've been reading that the French wine grape crop is like 40% of normal this year due to climate change. Is that true?
I think extreme weather events are certainly more common. If you think about early harvests in terms of some of the classic French wine regions, places like Champagne, for example, where they never normally have ever picked, where harvest was something that you did in October.
Mm-hmm.
And now, four times, I think, in the last decade, they've started to pick in August. So I have never met a farmer, certainly not a vigneron, who doesn't think that climate change is a very real problem. But it's way out in different ways. Things like having warm winters are very bad for soil structure and for the persistence of diseases. Having warm springs actually paradoxically lay people very vulnerable to late frosts, because everything's just developed enough that it becomes vulnerable to the consequence of frost. And then, as some wine regions have suffered extensively this year, also hail from significant storms.
Well, you too, and us, we need to have dinner together because we have a lot to talk about.
Yes, we do.
So next time we're in London, you may get a call.
Absolutely. We'll look forward to it.
Great. So again, it's Bronwyn and Francis Percival, Reinventing the Wheel, an absolute requirement for understanding the cheese world today and tomorrow. Thank you for talking to us.
Thanks so much.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Finally, here's a new category, I guess, of careers and professions you might look into, culinary historian. And Laura Shapiro is really an expert at digging through history.
She's one of those, right?
She is one of those. And she tackles all these. She has an idea that what you eat is as important as what you've done, just about, or the almost interchangeable. So she's selected six remarkable women, and she tells their stories, what they did, but also what they ate, which is the name of her book, What She Ate. You know, I wondered what a food historian really is, and I think, Laura Shapiro, you really fit any a specific definition of it very well with what you just did with your book called What She Ate. It's subtitled Six Remarkable Women, The Food That Tells Their Stories. Now, we're going back to that old adage, tell me what you eat and I'll tell you who you are, or is it what you are?
That was Brilla Severin, right?
Brilla Severin.
He said all kinds of smart things.
Yeah.
He was like Oscar Wilde.
Yeah. So tell me, what gave you this idea?
Well, I've always written about women and food in particular, and I've often written about women who are well known for food, Julia Child, Fanny Farmer,
exactly.
People like that. I got to thinking that you don't have to be a cookbook author. You don't have to be a professional in the kitchen we all have relationships with food, and I could tell a lot of stories about women and food if I started looking at women who they may not even have cared what they ate. They may not ever have cooked a meal, but they had a relationship with food. And if you look at that relationship, you're going to be able to see things in their lives. It just seemed to me that food is a great window onto the whole world that people live in and who they are. And as I say, I stopped looking for, like, the great cooks, and I started looking at interesting women.
Okay. And so you found them. Some of them didn't even like food, right?
No, that's exactly right. I used Helen Gurley Brown, for instance, who talked all the time about food. As you know, she wrote Sex and the Single Girl, and she was the editor of Cosmopolitan for many years. Her subject was women and sex, really. That's what she wrote about more than anything else. But food got a fair amount of attention, only what Helen Gurley Brown liked to promote was the idea of not eating. She wrote about food all the time and very enthusiastically, but her enthusiasm was all about how to resist, how not to eat that delicious thing, how to eat the sugar-free version of it instead, or the fake version somehow, or just to eliminate it entirely and just eat lettuce leaves. She kind of made an art form, or I think she would have thought of it that way, of resisting food.
Well, now, let's just very quickly, because I would hate to leave anybody out, because they're all very interesting people. But let's go down your cast of characters. Helen Gurley Brown, we just mentioned.
Why don't we start at the beginning of the book,
William's Wordsworth's sister.
Yeah, that was the one that I think I found most compelling, because I didn't even know who she was. And it was so sad, wasn't it?
There is some sadness there. What interested me about Dorothy Wordsworth was the difference between this very happy, idyllic life she had keeping house for her brother, the poet William Wordsworth, and how that changed in the course of her life, and how you could see that change in the food that surrounded her. And then the next woman, at least chronologically, was Rosa Lewis. Now, she was the one person in the book who was a food professional, but her life was so interesting, I couldn't resist her. She lived in Victorian and Edwardian England. She was born working class. She started out as a scullery maid. She cooked her way up the social ladder until she was making meals like escoffier, that fantastic 19th century French food. She was doing it for the most noble families, including royalty in England. And in many ways, she too raised her class, but not completely. So there was a very compelling story there that had to do with food and class. And
yeah,
then I get to Eleanor Roosevelt.
Yeah, that was another surprising one, but surprising, and I don't know if that's not exactly the term. It's kind of what I expected, actually, of her. But I found her totally fascinating in real life. I mean, in all her biographies I've read and so forth.
Yes. She, of course, had an incredible life, and what I found about her food was that she had a kind of austere, puritanical view of food while she was in the White House. Outside the White House, on her own, she was much more open to the warmth and conviviality of food. And you really see kind of two Eleanors. When you look at her through food, you see two different people. And
yes.
then I have Eva Braun, Hitler's mistress. And here's somebody whose life was actually quite difficult to research in terms of food, because she didn't leave much of a personal record herself.
She's really pretty, huh? You have a photograph of her with Hitler.
Yeah, she was a pretty young woman, it's true. Why she made this choice and why she lived the way she lived is something that was so inexplicable. That's really what I was looking to find. I was hoping that food could help me ask those questions and answer them. And I did see that she used food, or she used food as a kind of way to consolidate her the person she wanted to be. She wanted to be the beautifully dressed, consort of the great Hitler. That's how she saw herself. So she would eat very daintily. She would just eat the salads and the fruit and so forth, but always a glass of champagne. And that was how she kind of saw herself. She was wafting through the Third Reich in this bubble of champagne. It was a fantasy that supported her through the most terrible years Europe had ever known.
And in the bunker.
Yes, and then this horrible conclusion in the bunker, where her real last meal was, of course, a cyanide tablet.
Yeah.
And then I get to Barbara Pym, who's a very nice change of pace here after Eva Braun. Barbara Pym was a wonderful British novelist. She published in the 50s and 60s mostly, and the books are full of food, and she uses food to tell you about the characters, to establish them in terms of class, gender, culture. She really believed in food as a key to character. So she was a food person through and through. So that was she's a pleasure to write about. And then, as I say, Helen Gurley Brown. So it's a very motley crew, I must say. And I used to like to think of them all sitting up there wondering what on earth I was doing with all these books and papers about them and how I would put them together.
Did you sort of put them together around a dinner table?
Yes, I did. And, you know, all of them, the other five, eyeing Eva Braun with great suspicion.
I think quite a few of them would have looked at the others rather querulously. Querulously, that's a good word. Huh?
Yeah, querulously. I wonder
why they were in the book. I was actually disappointed. There's a missing person in there. Right between Barbara Pym and Helen Gurley Brown, there's a place for Nora Davidson.
His mother.
who was my mother, who imposed a world of food that was a little bit like the nasty side of Eleanor Roosevelt.
Oh, how interesting. But, you know, what you're saying is exactly kind of my point of the book, is that we all have a food story. And if we look at the people around us or people we don't know, anyone, look at them through the food, you will see things. You will find things out.
Yeah, I did. Found a lot of things out.
Yes.
I made it through childhood. That was pretty good.
Okay, good.
So what does you do now?
Exactly. Now I cook. but I can't be in this book. Because it's what she ate. It's not what,
right.
It's not what he ate. Although there is a fairly substantial hero in there called Edward the Seventh to become. Before that, the Prince of Wales. He's quite a hero in the Rosa Lewis section of the book.
Yes, there was somebody who really enjoyed the good life and the food that came with it. And of course, he was the prince and the king at a time when London was just afloat on this great French cuisine. It was a food capital in a huge way.
It's coming back. The whole French stuff's coming back to London, by the way.
Well, now he's,
all right.
He's,
and
he's,
these French chefs, they're all falling over themselves, trying to invent dishes that will please Edward. And, of course, Rosa Lewis, who cooked for him very often, cooked for a kind of different appetite that the king had. He could eat all the French food anybody could serve to him, but what he was really hungry for were these kind of the boiled bacon and the boiled beans and these British nursery dishes that,
yes,
you know, have just such a place in the heart of the British. And Rosa used to cook those things for him.
Now, he probably had to enjoy food a lot, because his mother did not think very much of him and did not allow him any role whatsoever in the government.
That's right.
So he never attended a cabinet meeting until he was king.
Yes.
And here's a masterpiece of trivia for you. Why is it that you think that the gentlemen of, first of all, the gentlemen of the court in late 19th century England, and now gentlemen the world over, leave the bottom button of their waistcoat undone?
Well, is that kind of an homage to Edward, who was so fat?
Was it homage to Edward, the Prince of Wales, who, when he had a particularly elegant and sizable repast, would undo the bottom button of his waistcoat. So everybody copied that. Most people don't know that, but that's how it happened.
That's very nice. So my portrait of him in this chapter is quite accurate, I see.
Yes.
If it shows him with the bottom button of his waistcoat undone, the answer is yes.
Laura, I'm going to ask you something a little bit off the grid here. What about people you see in the news or you encounter in real life that you've made impressions, sort of pretend like you were writing one of these chapters on them? I'd be just interested in your observation on some characters in today's society.
Well, you know, something struck me, exactly what you're talking about, something struck me recently, which was all of the fuss in the internet and in the news about Trump's fondness for this chocolate cake that was served to him at Mar-a-Lago. And as you recall, he was talking to an interviewer on television about ordering the missile strike in Syria. And he said he had ordered it. He said, "We're having dinner. We're just having dessert. We're eating the most delicious chocolate cake you can imagine." And he had ordered this. And immediately, all over the internet, people are saying, you know, "Oh, he's eating chocolate cake while he's doing this." But it was very interesting because they showed, somebody then got a picture of the chocolate cake as they made it at Mar-a-Lago. And it was fascinating because it was a lovely looking chocolate layer cake. And, you know, sort of decorated restaurant style with all these, you know, all this kind of ornamentation, including an insignia that said Trump, just the way the Trump buildings all announced themselves to be Trump. Right. The cake announced itself to be Trump. So I started thinking, you know, here is, he's singling this out. He's praising it. It's his favorite, most delicious cake. It's and the cake that shows up in front of him has his name on it. Well, where do we get cakes with our name on it? It's our birthday, and everybody's standing around and singing to us, and the cake comes with our name on it. We're the center of attention, and everybody is showering us with love and affection. I think that shows a streak of the child at the most, like the peak experience of a child's life, to be there when the chocolate cake comes out, served directly to them. And he's got that streak. He wants that attention.
Yeah, well, what
it's
about,
all about him.
Yeah, what about his thing with ice cream? Now, that I love.
Does he like ice cream, too?
He loves ice cream, but he's trained the staff, the White House dining staff and serving staff, that as is a custom, everybody gets one scoop of ice cream for dessert, and he gets two.
So,
I mean, isn't that amazing?
Yes. So it's exactly what you're saying. When you get these little bits of information about public figures, sometimes they really jibe with what else you know about them.
Right.
I don't think we really want to go there any further. we don't know who you voted for, so we better not go into that conversation.
Right. Well, I don't mean to be too political, but it certainly was one of the most striking things that people glommed onto, and everybody was interested. Everybody likes sweets. Everybody's interested in Trump.
Well, you know, one of the things I always found interesting was Sophia Loren's insistence on pasta. She did that right through that whole carbophobia stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, I think that it has an identity issue that's very deep, very profound.
Well, of course. And she has always, throughout her career, symbolized Italy in one way or another. So she certainly was not about to say, "Oh, forget that, just bring the carrots."
Yeah. Well, we could go on, couldn't we? It's sort of like a fun game. Stop it, Laura? I mean, do you keep doing it all the time?
Oh, I think about it all the time. You know what? We live in New York, and I remember when we moved here, it was so wonderful to me. It was summer when we moved to the city. You could walk up the street, and all the restaurants have their tables out on the sidewalk, And New Yorkers are very accustomed to people being rude. Rudeness is a, you know, it's a national characteristic in New York. So you walk up the street and you can practically lean over into people's plates if you want to see what they're eating. And I always do want to see what they're eating. And my husband had sort of pulled me back. I was just so curious about what was on those plates. And they're eating in public. And, you know, in New York, everybody does eat in public. They eat on the subway. They'll eat in the little, that little strip of garden that runs down the center of the big Broadway and Park Avenue. Somebody's sitting on a bench there having lunch. You can always watch people eating. So for someone like me who's insanely curious about what everyone's eating, it is paradise.
Oh, my. Yeah, well, anyhow, are you working on your next book, I'm assuming?
I'm trying to be open in my imagination so that when the idea pops out of the stratosphere, I'll be ready for it. That's kind of how it has to happen.
Well, that's what happens. I don't know. I keep waiting. I always wanted to write a novel, you know, which is how I started out. But at any rate, nothing has popped into my head.
Well, we wish you a wonderful summer and come back refreshed with ideas for another book like What She Ate.
That was What He Ate.
a much more interesting subject.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today, and we wish you better weather.
Thank you. Thanks very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
Thanks
a lot.
Thanks, Laura. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We couldn't figure out whose turn it was. I guess if Anne's not saying anything, it must be my turn. This is Peter unusually saying that it's time for us to go till same time, same next week. And here's Anne to say
bye-bye.